We're visiting with Mark Thompson on December the 4th, and Josh Post is here with me, and I'm Larry Howard. And what I'd like to do is have your okay for whatever we record to be used, you know, at Holden, people, we put these things on the audio archives, which sure. are public, and people will come in maybe and research, do some research, so we'd like your permission to use it in those types of Holden Village benefiting, you know, type activities. Absolutely. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. I guess maybe the best way to start it is just give us your timeline as to how you wound up there, and then just start telling stories. And like I said, we'll check them off as we go.
About the time Wes was doing his work, Wes mm-hmm. Craig, Gil mm-hmm. Berg was one of the board members of LBI. Mm-hmm. Gil Berg was also one of the higher members in our church.
Okay.
My dad was on the same board as Gil.
Oh.
And so my dad and Gil and a bunch of others, we started working at different, they started working on these different things. I had just come out of the service, so I wasn't working full time. My uncle, Reuben, had moved out here. He had a problem back in Minneapolis. He was a confirmed alcoholic, and they just wanted to get him away from his friends there. And so he was living with us. Actually, he helped me build part of this house.
Oh.
And but when it came time to, the Forest Service said, yes, you can have this, you can do this, but you must have somebody here 24/7. There's got to be a person all the time at the village. He obviously wasn't working. He could do that. And his family was fine with him being gone. He had been gone from them for a long time. So on Mother's Day of 1961, my folks, we had ridden the boat up. We got Oscar Getty to get loan us the truck. We got up to about 7 miles before we ran into too much snow to get through. And we unloaded what we had come up with. My folks drove the truck back down, and we didn't see him then for some time. It took us 3 more days to get our stuff into the village. Not thinking about it, I mean, we had packed all kinds of weird things in suitcases. What are you doing with 2 18-inch pipe wrenches in your suitcase? And, you know, this type of thing.
You never know.
Well, and it turned out we used them a lot.
Yeah.
Because so many pipes were broken up there. Mm. The place had been closed for 4 years. Some damage had been done by people walking through. There had been people up there, and Wes was one of them. They had left little notes and said, well, the loggers are here. The people are doing the demo work on the village or on the mine. If you forget something or need something, then you can just go out and flag them down, and they'll give you a ride to Lucerne. Well, that wasn't true.
Not the winter.
Nobody was there. And we never saw anybody because that work had been done. Mm-hmm. They had demoed the things, they had salvaged the things. They only had a salvage permit for so long. Then they had to leave. But in the process of salvaging things, they had taken out the transformers and all the power. So there was no electrical power up in the village for quite some time. Rube and I spent about 3 weeks just looking through the various houses, what's here, what's not there, what do we have to fix. And then
So you had a charter to actually start bringing things back into usable condition.
We knew that that's what they wanted.
Okay.
So it was just, nobody said, go fix this, go fix that.
Okay.
Mm. It was, but where are we? What, mm-hmm. What's mm-hmm. here? Mm-hmm. We had never seen the village, never seen the mine. And it's interesting that the village is the houses and the hotels and so forth. That's Forest Service land. Where the mine is, that's holding land. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, there's a complete separation there. Mm-hmm. What you can do here, you can't do. Or what you can do over there, you can't do here.
Right.
And one of the things we were trying to do, and those wrenches came in very handy, was trying to turn the water on. Because there was, besides no electricity, there was no water. So mm-hmm. let's go down to the river and get a bucket of water and come back with it.
Right.
About 5 or 6 days after we were there, many trips up to the water tank, we finally got that valve opened, and when it opened, we found water squirting out of every fire hydrant around, and so now we had to start shutting things down. Turn this one off, go down, shut this one off, now turn the water back on, and pressure would build up, and it started squirting over there. So it's just a fun job getting that working. Then Gil and a group of board members came up, and I believe it was Bertha was going to be the cook.
Now, when was that? That next spring?
No, what? It was that same
in the
year of 61.
Okay,
late May, early June.
Right.
So I think just
before the Forerunners got there.
Mid June or something.
Yes.
Like that.
And. She had confided in Rube and I that she had never cooked for anybody more than her family in her life. And Gil had brought up like 30 people. And there wasn't a working stove. There was nothing inside. There was an outdoor grill, mm-hmm. Barbecue area. That's where all the cooking was done. Within the first day that group was there, we made a refrigerator out of the fish pond that was behind house one. We opened up one of the fire hydrants, ran the water through, had about 6 garbage cans with rocks on them to hold them down, lids over them, put a tent over the whole thing. And water was very cold, so things at least kept somewhat refrigerated.
Wow. And when you talk about house one, that's chalet one?
Yes.
Okay.
The one right down at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
The way I always had them was it was house one and it went all the way around the corner to house 16.
That's still the way it is. Yeah. Okay.
There was a lot of pipes that were broken. Every time we would turn water onto a house, it was like, oh, I hear water running. And there's a leak here, there's a leak there. We'd find all the leaks and what do we need to patch it? Mm-hmm. Shut it back off again and go on to the next one. Mm. And then start getting the stuff to patch the leaks. Some of the dorms were, for us, they were beyond repair. They were repairable, but we didn't have the expertise or the manpower to fix them up. So it was just leave that one closed, we'll go on to the next one. Mm-hmm. The hotel was amazingly in good shape.
Hmm.
Had just a few leaks. We had a batch of patches that you can put on a pipe.
Hmm.
It's a stainless steel neoprene patch. You put it on there and tighten up the bolts and seal up the leak.
You came up with those in your...
It was something that was available.
Okay.
They weren't there,
okay.
But I can't remember how we got them, but we did a lot of patching mm-hmm. with those things. And then it was the big thing. We knew that the Forerunners were coming. We had been told that they would happen this day. We were still using Oscar Getty's truck to do everything. And I had left and gone over to Seattle, and Gil said they had bought a truck. And so I wound up driving the 2.5-ton corn binder up there. Took it to the bottom of the, or to the lake. They put it on the barge and took me up.
It's still there.
It's still there. It's a good truck. The after it got up there, it was the road was still closed. There was still too much snow to get on it. But the loggers were coming up at the same time. We always call them the Swiss loggers. I don't know where they actually came from. I believe they were Swiss, but but they were Highline loggers. And they asked if they could put some stuff on the truck. Sure, I'm going up the hill, but would you finish plowing the road so I can get up the hill? Sure, they'd do that. They had some amazing equipment. And to say that they were very strong, they weren't that. They weren't like 7 feet tall or this type of thing. But when I watched one of them take a 55-gallon barrel of gasoline, bend it over his knee, pull it up with his fingers into his lap, and walk up to a four-wheel drive Ford and push it into the...
You knew that something...
I didn't want them to grab me by the arm.
No, not at all. Gee whiz.
As we started going up, everything was going fine. I just followed behind the bulldozer. Got up to where there was some trees down. One of the loggers got off the bulldozer and grabbed his chainsaw. Well, they don't use chainsaws with 18-inch blades. They have start out 2- and 3-foot blades. And this man just picked up an oil and gas can and a chainsaw in his hand and started it and walked up. And with one hand, he was cutting this log up in pieces. And he'd walk up to the next one. The dozer would show it off to the side. And he probably cut up about 20 trees on the way up.
Didn't even raise a sweat.
He didn't even think about it. Most of the time, he didn't even shut the saw down. Just walked on to the next one. Dozer cleared it out, and we got us all the way to the village. The village itself was clear. But in the shady spots from about 10 miles down, there was, there might be 2 feet of snow, and then there'd be bare, and then more snow. So that's what took so long to get the our baggage up the first time, is the fact that we found a baby buggy, or we found a sled. Put everything on the sled. Well, you can't drag it on dirt. Then we found a baby buggy in one of the things, so we put the sled on the baby buggy, and we'd drag and pull and drag.
Nice image.
Yeah. But like I say, the Swiss loggers got us in there and got the truck up. And I made, I think, 2 more trips down while they loaded stuff on the truck, and we brought it up. One of the things I brought up was their bicycle. And the other was their spool of inch and, it was so many millimeters, but basically it's 1⅜-inch cable that would span from the road all the way to the top of Buckskin Mountain. And then they would just stretch this thing tight.
Yeah.
Highline logging, they'd just pick up the logs and take them down. I
top
always...
of Buckskin.
I think it was... What's it?
Martin Ridge?
Well, no, up the other...
Up Buckskin, sure.
So it's... Yeah. Copper Peak, Buckskin?
Is yep.
But that's the hillside they were logging. And I kept asking him, how do you get this cable up there? Oh, that's easy, easy. But one of the guys would just grab a 3/8 cable, that 90 horsepower air-cooled diesel donkey motor had about 5 spools of cable on it. And one of them was this little 3/8 tagline. And he would just walk out here about 400 feet, wrap it around a tree, call it up. It would just pull itself up, and he'd undo it, walk up some more, and he walked to the top of the mountain doing that.
How interesting.
In the meantime, it was playing out another line behind him. They hooked that onto that 1⅜-inch cable and pulled it up. And they had a deal where they would tie it to this tree, and then they came up higher on that tree and tied it to two trees, and then they went up higher in that and tied it to two more trees. And so you were going to get a half a forest down when that cable
right. pulled.
And it did the same thing down at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And after they got it stretched tight, they used the bulldozer down at the bottom and the tagline on the back of the bulldozer to pull it tight. But it was, there was places where it was 200 to 300 feet off the ground going this way as the mountain was going that way. Very interesting watching them walk. But it, like I said, then the forerunners came up. By then we had cleaned out some of the houses. We'd cleaned out. The hotel wasn't fully up operational yet. It didn't have power to run the boilers. Mm-hmm. So Bertha was still cooking outside. Mm-hmm. There was a group of them that they were on wood cutting details, and this one was on water, and this one on washing. And just each one of them had a separate batch of jobs. And the forerunners, as I remember, were more taking care of getting it so people could live there or stay there, whether they lived or not. That was, let's clean the houses up, let's fix the things that are broken, we need to repair our parts, get those. And then I left after about two, three weeks of the forerunners. I left and came back. I still had military service I was doing, so reserve would call me back, and I still didn't have something to do, so I went back up, and I was there when the second group came up. And then I went back down. I came a couple more times just to see Rube for a week or two. And in 64, I was hired by the Holden to be a carpenter on the site. Mm-hmm. And most of my work was still repairing this porch, repairing this. It was just repair work. Until they got here was a plan for rebuilding Coronita Hall or Lodge? I can't remember.
Coronita.
And
Lodge 5.
Yes. We cut the holes in the floor, poured the foundation blocks for the poles to sit on, had measured very carefully, cut holes up in the second floor, married from there up to the roof, knew the exact, down to the 16th of an inch, what each one of them had to be. I and others cut the logs 3/4 of an inch short. But we couldn't get them in. It wasn't until basically the place was closing down in September. We got the logs down here, and they had them all peeled and laid out and drying and so forth. Elmer Field had located 36-foot rough cut 6x12s, as well as 20-some foot. And those are the beams that are up on the ceilings. Mm-hmm. And when he loaded that, he loaded up a truck full of cedar boards that wound up being the cedar on the inside of the lodge, as well as the 1x2s that covered it. Lots of insulation, and then he had these timbers over the top of them. Mm.
Were those milled on site, or where
no,
are they?
No, Ballard Lumber, or the sawmill on Ballard.
Okay.
At that time, was the only mill around that could mill something that big. Mm-hmm. And rough cut it.
Right. So now, originally, that bottom floor area where the Quinnia Fireside Room is, that when you first got there, that was already open.
No.
Is that correct?
No, we tore it open.
Those were all bedrooms downstairs too?
Just like all the rest of them. That hall was exactly the same as 2 and 3.
Okay.
I knew that they had built the buildings fairly strong because I had opened up different portions of it. I'm not an engineer, but my construction said that's going to stay up there, no problem. We tore out all the bearing walls except the two hallway walls all the way up to the roof.
Uh-huh.
And I had the holes cut. Before everybody left, we got the 6 logs inside. But we didn't have any way of getting them up right then. And the people were all leaving, so it was then Reuben, Harvey, and myself stayed that winter. And come next spring, we had the 4 posts, main posts in. We had the 4x6, or the 6x12s bolted to the side, and we had jacked them up to the roof. Because it had taken us so long to do this, wintertime it's very cold, had lots of snow, normal 7 feet or better. The day that we put those, we're going to jack the logs up and set them on the foundation, I measured the roof again and I said, I can't believe this. So we kept going with it, went outside and measured, there was 9 feet of ice on top of that roof. And all the bearing walls have been taken out. And it's not a trust roof. It's nailed together.
Right.
2x8s and 2x10s.
Mm-hmm.
It had sagged a 1/16 of an inch.
1/16?
Yes.
Lord. Oh, my goodness sakes.
Put the jacks underneath it, raised it up. I had some steel plates. Got it up until it hit, got the last little, because I'm lifting the ice.
Yeah.
Slid the 3/4-inch steel plates underneath it, there it sat.
Well, now it's spring-loaded for spring. Gee whiz.
Then after we did that, then we went up in the attic, and we started making trusses out of the rafters that were up there, because the bearing points now were 5 feet in some from the edges instead of down the center.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to get a little more bracing. We felt we had to do that. Probably wouldn't have had to, just because of the way they built that building and the houses. If you read the books that the logs that the mine left behind,
yeah,
I believe they said they had 500 carpenters, loggers that cut the trees, milled them, and made the lumber to build all those houses. And they did that for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of work going on there.
Yeah.
They worked for 2 years up there without digging an inch into the mine. That hadn't been done yet.
Yeah.
But that's how I got that part. The fireplace wasn't there when I left. I left in 65. Karen and I got married, and I came down. I went back up a couple times to help them with a project. I know I was up there to help put the stack for that fireplace. In the 2 winters that I stayed there, that's where I told you that it was so stinking cold that one winter.
Yeah.
The snowmobile that somebody had donated was a Ski-Doo snowmobile.
It was a what?
A Ski-Doo. They're still making them today. But they didn't have the power that the new ones have. Going down a steep hill, it might get up to 30. If you put two people on it, you'd go faster. But if you're going back up, it went slower. And it got extremely cold. We had, during the same, in 64, they also put in the diesel plant. And so there was two diesels there. I believe they're hooked to 50 kW generators. Mm-hmm. But they had shut those down. They'd actually did that in like 63, but diesel fuel was very expensive. And so they had shut it down. In the wintertime, there was basically no electricity. We had about a 4,000 watt generator, 3,000 watts, something like that. Down in house one, we had it out on the back porch. And we would fill a gas tank with gas, fire it off, make dinner, clean up, and then it would either peter out after. By the time you got everything cleaned up and the fire set up and going. But house one was not a good house to be in. It was a good house only from the standpoint that it had a big fireplace and a nice kitchen and a wood stove kitchen and a big wood-burning fireplace. But it, because it was so big, it was always cold.
Right.
You just couldn't keep it warm, and you couldn't let the fires go out. The kitchen stove had to run all the time, and the fireplace had to run all the time. So it took a lot of wood. And the Forerunners and the other groups, every year when there was a group up there, it was like, okay, let's... we need you 20 people to go out and cut wood, split it and stack it in this house and fill it all the way up to the stairway, top of the stairway. One of the other things I did work on was the hydro plant was being built. And it's one of those things that's hard to believe. Here's a hope. A, there was no plans for it. The engineer that had found the pelting wheels and the rest, he knew they were over in Idaho, and he was going to get them over here, and he was going to wire it in, and he was going to do this. And he said, we need a building this big by this big. They had the foundation actually poured before I came back. But then it was, we need the penstocks. We need also the thrust block because we're going to take the water from up here and take it down in. We cleaned out down to bedrock on the mountainside, drilled 2-inch holes into the mountain, put a bunch of, today we'd call them quick bolts, but they're anchor bolts, down into there and up. Ran the pipe down, a 14-inch pipe down, came up, broke out into two 8-inch Ys. Mm-hmm. Ran those into the building, and then built this big thrust block that didn't want to touch the building, but be very close to it. And I cannot remember the man's name that was doing the design work. But he calculated the bump force if there was a 10-inch or a 10-foot burp in the pipe. If the pipe got uncovered up here and you got 10 feet of air and then the water came again.
Oh, hammering, yeah.
The hammer that would hit was in the hundreds of tons. It's like, oh, yeah, right. We decided we had to pour the concrete. Didn't want to pour it when it was real hot. Concrete doesn't like that. And I cannot remember how many kids they gave me, but the first thing we did is went down to about 3-4 miles, somewhere down in there. There was a hillside that had a lot of gravel in it. Uh-huh. And the 2.5-ton truck would go up there, back up tight, and the logger's bulldozer would fill it up and we'd drive it up and wash the dirt out of it, get a big stack of rock. Did the same with the sand. They would back it up and they would push, the bulldozer would shove the sand out onto the little blue pickup, 3/4-ton pickup. Oh yeah, it was heaped. And it couldn't drive out.
Poor little truck.
Yeah, so they'd grab a hold of the front axle and they'd pull it out with the bulldozer. Well, after about the fifth load, it just broke in half.
Yeah,
sat
right,
down there.
Right.
Oh. Harvey did a lot of fixing. But we got the sand and gravel up there. It had two big stacks of it. Had lots of bags of concrete. And early in the morning, the kids that were paying $3 a day to stay there, they were the high school kids, or graduated from high school, but they were, their folks were paying to have them stay there for 30 days.
Well, the folks paid the village $3 a day.
Yes.
Oh.
That's what it cost to have each one of the kids up there.
Right.
Or that's what the kids got billed. But they got out there when the sun was just thinking about getting up, and we started mixing concrete. I don't know who got a hold of the one-yard mixer, but we had pushed it to a point where you could shovel all the stuff into the bucket. It would raise up, dump into the mixer. You counted so many revolutions, and you'd dump it out this side, and it would go down the trough into the piece we were pouring. They were pouring concrete until about 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Wow.
1 yard at a time. And you know, get it down there, vibrate it, do all the rest of the things. These kids did absolutely amazing things. They laid the pipe, the 14-inch pipeline, high-pressure pipeline, came up. Logging trucks would pick it up down Lucerne, bring it up and unload it. And these kids would pick up those 40-foot sections and walk up the mountainside with it.
Wow.
See, that was Mark Bierke. I think Mark Bierke is still around, and he's got pictures and tales of doing this.
It's like,
I looked at some of those pictures and I said, I wonder you didn't kill yourselves.
Yeah. I talked to it was the engineer that would put each one of them together because they're a special coupling that bolts up. They're not flanged, they're just blank on both ends. And you push this thing down, you pull this rubber piece up. When you bring this one down, you roll the rubber over it, and then you start bolting it up, and it just squeezes everything up tight. I asked him, I said, you're putting your pinkies down there, and these guys are still holding on to that piece of pipe.
Uh-huh. Where's OSHA?
yeah. And he said, I trust them more than I would if there was a crane holding it. He said, they don't wiggle.
Interesting. How interesting.
When it came down, he said, that's it. He said, I think I could go eat lunch and come back, and it would still be there. They just wouldn't move. Like you say, where's OSHA? OSHA right. Hadn't been thought of yet.
No.
They did have to get a bulldozer to backfill it. What Rube and I and Harvey were so worried about was that one winter then, just first part of 65, was that it was going to get so cold, it did get that cold, that we tried to keep water running through that pipe. Didn't have the turbines running, but we just dumped water. But it started getting slushy, and so it would clog up with slush. And we said, you know, we gotta get some heat in here. And the only heat there was, you could have some electric heat. You couldn't build a fire in there. So we had to get the diesel started to get this started. But the snowmobile was broke down. So we weren't gonna start the diesels until we get lots of fuel up there for it. And Harvey and I decided to walk out And that's why I was telling you, we walked for 12 hours the first day and we got down to 10 miles.
Correct.
It had snowed more than 7 feet in like 2 days. But it was this really, it was 30 below zero, so it was this really light, fluffy snow. And what happened is the cold came down from Glacier Peak and just filled up the valley. So if we went up here, it was warmer. But the cold wouldn't wash out of the valley. There was no wind to make it go away. So we walked down that first mile, broke all the trail, came back. Rube knew me. He knew we were coming back. No radios, nothing like that. He just knew that we weren't going to make it. And he had a great big breakfast made for us. And we sat there and gobbled breakfast down, and it was, both Harvey and I were so exhausted, we finished eating and then walked right out on the porch and got rid of it all. It wasn't going to stay down.
Oh, no.
And then we decided, okay, now tomorrow morning we're going to go. We need to have some water. We need to have some food, other things, and it's going to take a long time. We might have to walk all day. Mm-hmm. And it took us about 16 hours to walk down. Mm-hmm. First mile went pretty easy because now we had a trail. But after that, it was, you would walk for X number of, like 50-100 yard steps, lean forward on the ski poles and just exhausted. The other person would keep coming and not looking up, run right into you, go around you, keep going. And that, we just walked that way all the way down. Mm-hmm. We got down, Harvey, if it hadn't been for Oscar Getty, Harvey and I probably would have had severe frostbite.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what Oscar did when you got there. You called him from the top of the
3 mile.
Yeah.
Up, right up the top of the hill, the little crank and holler phone would go down. Mm-hmm. And Oscar said, go to this cabin. I can't remember the number, but he said, I'll go ahead and start a fire. We got down there, dumped off our packs and other stuff, and walked inside. And he just looked at us and he said, get all your clothes off. Why? But because, let's see, Oscar had been with the miners and the trappers even before that. Mm-hmm. So he was probably in his 80s, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. But he knew the woods. Mm-hmm. And always felt that if Oscar told you to do something, you better do it, because that's going to keep you alive. Mm-hmm. So we pulled our clothes off, and I'm down to my T-shirt and my underwear, and he said, no, I said, take your clothes off. And when you get them off, he had a big horse trough that he brought in, a big galvanized tub. He said, climb in. And up on that, they had sheet metal stoves. I don't know if you've seen those things, but if you build a good enough fire in them, they just glow red. Mm-hmm. And it was glowing red, and he had a big pan of water up on top of it, and he was taking pans of water and dumping it in the sink. And I mentioned to him that I didn't realize how cold I was until before I got in that pan. I pressed down hard with my hands on my legs, and normally you see a white spot where your fingers are. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any change. Mm-hmm. They were the same color.
Wow.
Before and after.
Wow.
And the thing that really got my attention was I pulled my underwear off and I found white snow stuck between my legs. I knew I was cold.
Yeah.
Just didn't know how cold I was.
Right.
Got in there and Oscar pulled two chairs up closer. Set glasses on the chairs, poured a big shot of bourbon in each glass, or whiskey in each glass. And I said, I don't drink. He said, you will. And at that time I didn't, but I did. He was absolutely right. I couldn't believe the pain of thawing out. Mm. But because this water wasn't hot, it was lukewarm, but it was quick to get your thought out. And he knew that, and we were, it was, didn't take long before we even had our arms down in the, because our hands were so cold. It felt good on our legs, and let's take care of the rest of it. And then I asked Oscar, he was getting ready to leave, and I said, aren't you going to stick around? And he says, I hate to get grown men to cry. I don't know that we did, but boy, there was enough pain there that we could have very well. And he came back quite a few hours later, and by then we were warmed up. We could actually get out and dry ourselves off and stand close to the stove. And, the house was warming up. That was the coldest I've ever been.
Well, I would hope so. That's gracious me.
The walking up and down, Ruby used to walk that once a week, all winter long, because the vehicles wouldn't drive. And you'd have snow slides that would cover the road so even a snowmobile wasn't going through. The trouble with, well, about 5 miles right in there, there's a bare hillside, kind of bare, and the roads are all exposed. And we found out that through experience that, you know, about 2 to 4 o'clock, if something's going to slide, 2 to 4 o'clock, don't go here, don't go alongside the buildings. This time of the year, 2 to 4 o'clock, it's coming off the roofs, big chunks, and you're not going to live with one of those. So it was just, there was just these things that Oscar knew all about them. We didn't.
Were there many snow slides when you were up there?
Every year.
Close to the village?
Oh yeah, every year. One of them came down right behind the fire station, that valley that came down there. Rube had gone with the Forest Service and had climbed up Martin Ridge to take a snow survey. And he and the dog went all the way up. And he got up to the top of Martin Ridge. He was right behind that slot that comes down. I think we called it the fire station. It was a garage. And the guy was saying, well, the easy part was walking up here in snowshoes. Now it's going to be hard because you're going downhill with snowshoes. Rupert looked around, took off his snowshoes. I said, I'll meet you at the bottom.
Oh, Lordy.
He just fell over backwards and slid all the way down. About 50 minutes later, he was down the roadway. And poor old bugger, it's just all the way down. That, you know, you walk down to Lucerne, and going down, that dog would do, I mean, you did 11 miles, that dog would do 200 miles back and forth, and tracing bunny tracks and deer tracks or anything else, but coming back up, right alongside you all the way out here, it was pooped.
Yeah.
Just, and I don't know how many trips I made up and down. I know I made one of the fastest trips up. I was a skier, but a downhill skier. I was not a cross-country person. But I could skate if the snow was halfway decent. I could skate up that hill. And my shortest time up was about 3 hours to do the 11 miles. I made it down in less than an hour because it had frozen with a good thick crust of ice. And I was skating down and I got to the switchbacks and I went around the first corner and I slid right off the road and I just went down to the next one and down to the next one and down to the next one.
Oh, gee.
Got almost to the bottom and, oh, it ran out of snow and my skis didn't work very good on the dirt.
No.
My face planted out. But, you know, those were just things that I'm glad I got to do it.
Yeah.
I walked up once with a gentleman called Jerry Harris, good fellow I went to school with. And Rube had, I can't remember how we got the word. I think he had given the word to the boat company and they had called my dad. But he was really getting tired of instant potatoes. Mm. So we decided to take him with a bag of potatoes. You know, walking up that hill in the snow, in snowshoes, with a bag of potatoes is not...
No,
you just don't do that. Well, we did two stupid things. We took the bag of potatoes and we took a portable army radio, mm-hmm. field radio. The battery for the stupid radio weighed 40 pounds. And the radio was more than that. But we got up there and Jerry had never been on snowshoes and never been on skis.
Oh.
He was a basket case by the time we got up there.
Right.
I was a basket case trying to get him up there. But yeah, it was about an 8-hour trip going up. Yeah, just still had fresh snow.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So how much food would you typically kind of stockpile up there for the winter?
Most of the food would get there ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So in June, July, they would have, Reuben, here's smaller cans of peas, corn, all these other different things. Mm-hmm. A lot of cans of canned beef, corned beef hash, different things like this. While I was there, they had closed the place down and they had taken a bunch of the food out of the freezers over here. It was very cold. And they put it over in the over at the lunch counter in the gym, mm. and it was just really cold over there. Mm-hmm. So you could take frozen meat and just set it. They put it in one of the freezers over there, but it was more just to keep the rats out of it or
right.
animals. And Rube said, "You know, it's too bad we don't have some way of baking one of those big roasts." Because they had roasts that were big, huge. I went over and I grabbed one of those roasts and I went over into the box, going in the end, grabbed my skill saw, cut off a 3-inch slab and brought it back to him and said, "Cook that."
There you go. Right, that'll do it.
He said, "But it's got sawdust on it." I said, "It won't after you start burning it for a while." Harvey was good at that stuff too. And Harvey was really good at tremendous mechanic. Mm.
Now, he was up there during the winter with you guys?
Yes.
Yeah. Sounds like
there
that.
Was three of us.
Three
that,
of us.
That
okay.
Stayed that the winter of 64, 65. I was there in 63, and Harvey came really after the winter of 63. And then I left. They didn't renew my contract with them. And like I said, Karen and I were going to get married in April, so I came back down here where I could find steady work.
So which were the winters that you did spend up there?
63 and 64.
63 and 64.
Yeah.
Okay.
62, I was there probably a month of that winter, just okay. to go up and see my uncle.
This would have been in January, February, March of 62, somewhere in there?
Would have been right the last week of December and into January and February. Yeah, because it was... Rube's up there, it's Christmas, and went up to see him.
Okay.
And at that time, I wasn't committed to anything down here, so it was easy to go.
And he was up there by himself.
Mm-hmm.
Boy. How'd you guys keep from going crazy?
Played a lot of hearts.
Oh, okay.
Gin. And you never, ever wanted to play hearts or gin with Reuben and figure you were going to win. Because after you discarded twice, he would tell you what's in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
You also didn't ever want to play horseshoes with him. Because if you couldn't constantly throw double ringers, he would beat you. I'm sure somebody beat him sometime during the years he was there. But I don't know who. Because didn't matter which end he was on, they would walk back and forth. He might throw one or two where he just got one ringer. But after that, it was doubles and doubles and doubles and doubles. Okay, this game's over. You want to play?
So how about getting news? Because I was just thinking you were up there in November of 63, yeah. I imagine, when Kennedy was shot. So yeah, how long was it before
news
you knew?
For me, once a month I had to go to reserve meeting in Seattle.
Okay.
So I had to come down once a month.
Okay.
And that's when I would get things. I also could not break down and Rube could take and get enough water in the kitchen and warm and have a pan there, stove going full bore, and he could take a sponge bath. I just couldn't. I was too stinking cold.
Yeah.
So when I got home, my mother would say, "You straight in the shower." There was no hesitation.
Yeah.
I don't know that she even let me in the upstairs shower. It was downstairs shower. Go down the basement.
Well, what other quirks did Reuben have as far as being able to survive and thrive in that environment?
He could do that, but Rube had a... If you took a column of figures, he worked as a bank teller.
Oh.
And if you had a column of figures, 4 to 6 figures wide, he could put his finger on the top, draw it to the bottom, and give you the answer. No, that's not right. So you get out your little calculator. God, it is right.
Yeah.
And I say with cards, after dinner, because it's cold outside and it's also very dark outside in the winter, we had a card table that would sit about 2 feet away from the fireplace. Just enough room for the screen. And the three of us would sit around the card table. We'd put either a Coleman lantern or a kerosene lantern on the card table, and we'd sit and play cards. Reuben would 99% of the time. What you would have to do is when he told you what you had, you'd have to change. And just... No, I'm going to just throw all these hearts away.
Mark Deck.
He could just remember what was played. And you could take a deck of cards, shuffle them, and say that the Jack was 11, 12, 13.
Mm-hmm.
And you could shuffle those cards and throw them out just as fast as you could stop. And he would tell you the answer. He would add them up faster than you could throw them out. So, okay. How do you do that?
Well, who was the cook? Did you do some of the cooking, or did he do all the cooking, or what?
He did about 90% of it.
Okay.
But we all did some.
Yeah.
Where we had a little more trouble was doing things like these little cans of vegetables and so forth. They'd run out, so we'd go over and get from the stock that was left over from when the village campers had been there. The number 10 tin of peas lasts a long time for 3 people. and you don't dare open another can because there isn't a refrigerator you can put this one in. Right. Although we did
you
stick them out the
put
window.
Put it out on the porch. Yeah.
Well, it was easiest just to, the windows off the back side, the snow would be down there, so you just push them into the snow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But snow was not absolutely clean. Mm-mm. And so there was always a pot on the stove that was melting snow. So you keep it full of water, and you would keep throwing more snow in as you took water off. There was a smaller pot that, as you took water out of this one, we had two thin dish towels, mm-hmm, for drying dishes. And we'd have two layers on there and stick them down and then pour the water through that. And that would get rid of all the pine needles and that type of stuff. And, it, you know, if you're cooking with it, it tastes fine. But we were very careful in the fact that you use dish water. You had to wash your hands a little bit. That's fine. But that water was dumped over here. The bucket would get full after you washed your dishes. We'd use pot water right out of here to wash. You'd use a little bit of it to rinse. And then after you did that, you dumped it in this bucket down here, and that's what you flushed the toilet with.
Ah, okay.
So you use the water over and over and over again. Because otherwise, you just walk down to the stream and get some more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As long as the fire
kept... You didn't want to have to do that.
No, as long as the fire kept going, this smaller bucket, it was about 16 inches by about that high, so it was a good-sized bucket. That would just have a little bit of a boil on it. Not a hard
don't
boil.
Don't know what evaporated.
No, just the little bubbles that come up. Reuben liked coffee. He really liked his coffee. I could drink his coffee for about the first week, and after that I would give up on it, because he had one of those big blue porcelain coffee pots. So many cups of water, so many spoons of or cups of coffee grounds, and then just put it on the stove and let it boil.
Got stronger.
Well, it sat on the back of the stove 24 hours a day. So it would just sit there, boop, boop. And when it started getting low, he would just pour more water in,
sure,
and more coffee grounds. And when it got up to where there was only about this much water, well, then he would finally clean it out. But, you know, there was that much coffee grounds that were going bloop, bloop.
Yeah.
There was nothing left in that coffee. I just couldn't take it after a certain amount. And he seemed to think it was fine. And then what really endeared him to Bertha and even, who was the second cook?
I don't know. I didn't write it down when you told me it, so I'm going to write it down now.
Well, Bertha was the first one. But
his name starts with an S, doesn't it? Starts with an S. Do I remember that?
Karen might remember. I don't know.
Okay.
But she would take and make up a pot of coffee and set it on the back of the oil burner stove in the hotel. So when he was firing up all the boilers, the heaters in there, and firing up the stove, the rest of the stuff, he could come and pour himself a cup of coffee first thing in the morning. And there was always some cookies for him also. Mm-hmm. That she would also hide the cookies. They were never left out. The campers would eat the cookies. Or I would. Whoever came along first. But we took turns doing the... There was one person that would shut down all the boilers at night, and either the hydro or the diesel plant. And then one of us would start it up the next morning, and one of us would have a week off. Mm. And we had a little 1.5-volt dry cell, one of those ones that stood about that high and about that big around. And it was hooked to a doorbell, just a little doorbell ringer. And it was interesting because I could hear that, it would only get a couple dings, and I could be out of bed, have my clothes on, and heading down to the hydro plant, or whichever plant was running, to take care of whatever. There'd been a clog in the pipe, or the diesel plant had hiccuped a couple times. I could be down there and fix it. I could not. My bedroom was on the back side of the hotel, right where you walked in, where the air raid siren was mounted on the wall. Harvey slept in the same bedroom, and he liked the window open. I was right alongside that stupid bell. I never heard it. Never once did I hear that air raid siren, and they would run it every morning at 6 o'clock.
Huh.
To wake everybody in the village up that breakfast is going to be soon. I was absolutely blessed in the fact that I could sleep through whatever unless I have to hear it.
Yeah.
That little ding ding would go off, I'm up and running. Only if it was Harvey's turn, I never heard it. I only heard it when it was my turn. And I can't tell you how many fire department or how many fire drills they had. Lots. Every time a new group would come up, they would have a fire drill. And of course, each one of those little houses had all the fire hoses already coiled up inside them and hooked up. So all you had to do is grab a hold of the nozzle and run, and somebody turns it on. And you could have water in a hurry. That was the only protection the village had. Still probably is the only protection. Mm-hmm. There might be some, I think some of the buildings have sprinklers now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. But they didn't at that time. Mm-hmm. In the winter, there was only so much daylight. There was only, okay, we've got these beams up, now what are we going to do? I think we're through for the day or the rest. And we would just go, one of the places we liked to go, the mine was still open. So we'd walk back in the mine. It can be 20 degrees, 20 below. The mine was 55 degrees every single day. You'd walk in there and take off half your heavy duty mucklucks and start walking through. And we would take Ziploc bags of flour. Usually each one of us carried a good-sized flashlight, at least a 2-cell, with good batteries in it. We also carried 6-volt flashlights and a Coleman lantern. Every time you took a curve, you'd lay flour down on the railroad tracks. We went this way, so you always walked. Next time you went that way or that way, or you climbed up a ladder and went that way. There's one stope, I cannot think of the name of it, but it was, you could enter it from the 1500 foot level. And where we entered, it was like they got too close to that wall and it broke out, because it was just kind of a broken hole. It wasn't a drilled hole into the stope. And as we walked in, this is big. This is really big. Some of the stuff we found that the mine had left behind was maps of these different stopes. We realized that this stope went hundreds of feet up and hundreds of feet below us, and they had filled it with tailings. They were washing the tailings back out of these piles and stuffing them in there. And we started walking in there, and finally we said, well, let's not get lost in here. So we left the Coleman lantern sitting right there where that doorway was. And Rube took off walking this way, and Harvey took off walking this way, and I took off walking out this way. They lost track of each other. Their flashlights wouldn't shine that far.
Wow.
They wouldn't see the other person's flashlight. I could see both of them. They could see me. But I also lost track of the ceiling. I could not take that 6-volt light and hit the ceiling. It just
darkness.
But it just went up so high.
Yeah.
And as we came back around as a group, we were shining the light up all the different places, and then you saw, oh, here's the railroad tracks hanging down like this, and a couple hundred feet up, there's more tracks hanging down, and more tracks hanging down. So what they did to do their mining is they drilled in here, they drilled up what they could, hauled that out, drilled down, hauled out, but now the machinery wouldn't pull it up the hill. So they would go back out here, drop down 100 feet, go back in and drill up and drill down and drop all this down, haul it out, and just keep going down, down and down. 1,500 foot level is the main entrance, and the 3,750 foot level is the bottom of the mine. But even when we were there, there was so much water in the bottom that I would say there were probably close to 500 to 1,000 feet was filled up with water. Mm-hmm. But you could walk in at that time until I realized, you know, this is being stupid, because they had an elevator shaft here that did people, or not people, it did machinery. They had an elevator shaft over here that hauled ore. They had an elevator shaft over here that hauled people, and right alongside it there was a wooden wall, and there's a set of ladders that go all the way to the bottom and all the way to the top. You come down about 20 feet, there's a platform, you turn around, come over here, go down another 20 feet, you can keep going down.
Ah, okay.
I went down about 100, I think I went down 7 ladders. I said, I wonder how long these ladders have been here.
Yeah.
They're wood.
Right.
They're slimy wet. When am I going to hit one that's rotten? Mm-hmm. I think I'll get out of here.
Yeah.
And that was my... lots of places inside there. We walked into one of the smaller stopes, and the little machine room going over, or transport room going over there, had workbenches and stuff like that, and walked over to one workbench, and here's a box of dynamite. It's got about 7/8 sticks of dynamite in it, and they're all jellified. Mm-hmm. You could go tap them like that and have a very good explosion. Mm-hmm. Rube and Harvey and I, we very carefully picked it up.
Oh, you moved it?
Well, we took it outside.
Oh, jeez.
That main shaft, by the way, when you go in, it's about 1,500 feet long before it makes a turn.
Right.
And so we were up a lifter, and then came down, and then walked all the way out. Mm-hmm. Took it down by where the garbage dump was. Went back up on top of the stope pile, where they dumped the rocks out. Yeah. A couple bullets in there. Oh, it's a big bang. When they cleaned out the houses, when we cleaned them all out, lots of people had thought the mine was going to be in business for a long time. Mm-hmm. So they'd still been canning cherries and doing all these other things.
This is in Winston Camp now.
Homes? This is in the village itself.
Oh, okay.
Like house 13, okay. Or 10, 12, 13. But we'd go down in the basements and clean out all this stuff. I mean, you got cherries with a dome sitting up like this, you knew then, well, you better not eat one of those. Uh-huh. We found that just for entertainment, you could take them up to the garbage dump, and instead of just throwing them down and breaking them, if you put them inside a number 10 tin and then shot the tin number 10 tin, you could have an explosion of cherries that just went up forever. It's just a diversion of something to do. And of course, then all the different animals would come over and eat cherries and peaches and anything else that had been canned. You can't can them and leave them there.
Yeah.
If they canned them the day that they, the day before they left, it would have been at least 4 years before we got to them.
Yeah, right.
So
they come back.
It was probably 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
I was up there the day that they set fire to the miners' village.
Oh, really?
I watched the fires burning up there.
There's a slide of that.
Yes, there is.
Did they bulldoze down the houses first, though?
No.
Oh, I was under the impression they bulldozed it.
Nope. They walked around with the Forest Service fire starters and just walked around the houses and lit them on fire.
But did they do that in the spring or in the fall?
There was snow on the ground.
Snow.
So it was fall.
I think so. Okay.
But there was just the first, it was about that much snow.
Okay.
So it melted away from the houses, but then snowed over.
Right. And it wasn't going to start a forest fire.
Right. Yeah. And for the most part, there wasn't a lot of woods around those houses. Mm. There was woods, but not. They didn't have like a city burning or something like that. Mm-hmm. Start with this one and go up to this one.
Did you adventure through those houses?
I'd gone through them before. Mm-hmm. The book says that they had the strike, and the mine kept telling them, you know, you're gonna wind up closing the mine because we can't afford it. And well, they came back to work. Everything's happy. No, it's not. The mine said, I think it was on the 5th of September, they told the miners, mine's closing tonight. For the next 3 days, anything you put out on your front porch or down here by the road, we'll put it on company trucks and we'll take it down, we'll put it on the barge, and we'll unload it down in Chelan. Mm. Then it's yours. After 3 days, we're not running our barge anymore. Mm. So you've got 3 days to pack up your stuff. And some of those people have been there since 37. Mm-hmm. Their kids have grown up there. They've gone to school there. So they'd been there a long time. And when they left, I can't tell you how many houses we walked into, and it was like they had lunch, the plates were out, they'd finished up eating, or they left some food on their plates, and they just walked out. Mm. And you know, that was still there in those houses, even when they burned them, a lot of that stuff was still there. Mm.
Anything like that stands out about any one of those houses? Like,
no. Well, I thought it was sad that they were burning them all.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't feel bad about it because they weren't built to the same quality that right. these houses were. Mm-hmm. And so 4 years without heat and people living in them, they were starting to crumble all by themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they did have... they had power up there. They did have fire hydrants up there, so they could. They had water. I don't think they had sewers. I think they were septics. Mm. I'm not positive on that. I know the septic in the village. One of the later things that I did was work on cleaning that out. Mm. And it's a big tank, probably 40 to 50 feet square with divider walls. And they opened up a big section, dropped a bucket down in there, and they actually had people down in there walking around in it, shoveling all the stuff into the sludge, into the bucket. And
wow.
They pumped it out first, and then uh-huh. what wouldn't pump and go up on top of the tailings pile was dumped into buckets and hauled away and dumped and covered with lime and make it go away. Hmm.
When you first came that Mother's Day of 1961, mm-hmm. what was your impression of the village and the valley and the place.
Our first comments from a 10-mile, probably 9-8 miles somewhere down in there, you could see that tailings pile. The very west or eastern,
southern, south of
side of that tailings pile going up. I said, boy, that's a big pile of dirt.
Yeah.
And then it got bigger and bigger as we walked to it. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how long it took us before we ever got up on top of it. Gil Berg was, whenever people came up, Gil Berg, everybody had to walk up to the diversion dam. He didn't care how old you were. He could walk up there, you could walk up there. And these forced marches would go walking up to the diversion dam and back down again. He would take... The first load of people I took up there were in Oscar's truck. We had put sideboards up on it, and we had a lot of people in there, and I had taken and thrown ropes back and forth across, tied it off. So there was people in the center of that truck that were just holding on to a rope. And, you know, you go from the village, and you take go across the bridge, and you take this curve up here, and another curve up here, and head up, and we drop them off up by the mine portal. Gil thought it was really hilarious to reach down and pull out the power takeoff. The bed would start going up like this. I don't know how many times he did that while I was driving. It was like, Gil! We would put more people on that truck. I think the most I had was somewhere around 60. Mm. But to do that, there was two people standing on each running board. That part I remember. And the cab was full and the back end was just packed. Mm-hmm. So they weren't going to go very far when they started sloshing around. But...
Right.
And they got up there and there was one group of men that came up and they were going to see the feasibility of doing this and doing that and doing something else. They were all experts in a field. And, you know, everybody walked up, come down. Well, some of them walked down faster than the others. And so they stopped right up at the level of the portal. And this building is still standing here because the salvage people hadn't taken it down completely. And it still had a lot of those little 9-inch square windows. And I don't remember who, but somebody picked up a stone. Bitched out there. I think for the next hour, there was just a ton of rocks thrown at those windows. There were so many of these guys.
All these experts.
Oh, I could break a window.
Yeah.
And like I say, I can't remember how many times I drove people up, either in Oscar's truck or in the other truck to get them up to there so that we gotta go. You gotta go see the diversion dam. Mm. It was really a log across the creek. And the log sticking up this way and water would come in here and there was the pipe just came up underneath it.
Uh-huh.
What fell in and the rest just flowed back into the river. It wasn't like there was a dam. It wasn't 3 feet deep out there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was just a screen that when brush and other stuff would come down, the screen would catch it and the water flowing over it would wash it off and back into the creek.
Mm-hmm.
And they raised the dam or ran the pipeline up higher to get more pressure for the hydro plant. I cannot think of the person's name, but there was this engineer was putting together a hydro plant. He kept telling them, you know, one of the people that was a nature person was making a path for the water to come out of the hydroplant. And they put these little rocks, and they had a couple arch bridges across it, and winding it down, heading towards Railroad Creek. And you tell them, no, gotta straighten that out. And they took it to heart a little bit, but not much. And he called me into the hydroplant, and he says, well, the pipe is full, but 30 turns on the hydroplant opens the needle valve all the way. 30 turns on each one. Uh-huh. He said, when I tell you to, you start cranking as fast as you can.
And I was oh, no.
Well, to give you a visual picture, it's 55 gallons a second comes out of that. That's a 55-gallon drum. Every second goes by. Mm-hmm. Well, this windy little path just became a straight shot all the way down the Railroad Creek. The little bridges, they're gone. Oh. But he said, you know, if we're running full power, that's the water that's going to be here. Mm-hmm. Plan on it. Mm-hmm. Not build a path, fine. But here's the path the water's going to take.
Right. That
upset a few people.
Yeah.
You've mentioned Bertha a little bit.
Karen, who was the other cook?
Esther.
Esther.
I don't remember her last name.
I don't either.
What type of meals did she prefer? What variety did you have?
Bertha, because Gil was still there, mm-hmm. felt that these people are working hard. They need meat and potatoes. By the time they got into Hindley and some of the others, it was, where'd they get to, Karen?
Oh, I don't know. But when I was there, it was meat potatoes.
Yeah, it was not meat potatoes when
no.
Later on. It was
more of a vegetarian
type diet.
Well, you guys probably, I don't know if they still do that, do
they? Somewhat.
Yeah.
And of course, that all changed when the minor mediation people came in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're big, burly guys, and they're mm-hmm. working hard. And so they've got, you know, three to four different kinds of meat, and it just goes on and on and on.
Well, and then that's really, you know, when I was working with the kids, they worked their rears off.
Mm-hmm. You got to feed them.
And if they had been living on the vegetarian diet, they would have passed out after a week. Mm-hmm. There's no way.
Well, not bad. Just depends on. There are vegetarian and yeah, there's good food there.
Okay. I'll let you have my lettuce.
You were mentioning starting up the boilers, but when we were here before, you gave us kind of a schedule of what that regimen was like.
You always started up because you had to take care of the cooks. You went down in the hotel and you fired up the boilers there and you fired up the stove. Excuse me, take that back. Step back one. You fired up either the diesel plant or the hydro plant, whichever one was going to. The diesel plant quit running after the hydroplant was steady. But the hydroplant always turned off in the evening, so you had to start it back up again. Mm. It was running, but they didn't want to have power running all night.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
The diesel?
No, the hydroplant.
Oh, hydro, okay.
And so the first winter, summer, the diesel plant ran. And that gave them power to do everything. But it would run, you'd fire up the diesel, and you'd start turning on boilers. And if they had a lot of people in the village, then you'd go through the different dorms and fire up their boilers so they would have hot water. Mm-hmm. But then even then it started getting down to, you know, this diesel, the boilers are diesel also. It's costing too much to do that, so You just didn't have hot water. You had cold water. The hotel had hot water. Mm-hmm. When the hydro plant was working, you just had to throw all the switches in the right order and kick the power back over there. The first summer, when the Forerunners and the next group were there, one of the experts came up from Tacoma PUD, and he was a lineman. And these lines had sat for 4 years with snow and ice on them, and they had lots of sags in them, and they were just getting looser. And he started climbing up the poles, and buddies come along on there and cinch him up. And then he would go up this pole, and then he'd come down, and he'd go up this pole, and he'd come down and go up this pole. And he was just constantly going back and forth. And I said, would it help if I went up a pole? He said, yeah. Can you climb? I said, I have climbed trees. They're like poles. And the two poles that are on, they're on the Holden, the village side of Railroad Creek. They had concrete bases around them. Mm-hmm. They were about 80-foot poles. And he said, okay, you climb that one, I'll climb this one. And I got up 30, 40 feet. That's a long way down. And I'm not used to, if you sit back in your belt and use the belt the way it's meant to work, it works fine. But if you make love to the pole, your spurs kick out. So now you're shaky all the time. You can't get comfortable up there. And I did make it to the top, and there's a 6x8 cross beam, 2 6x8 cross beams. And the wires hang down to about that far, and then one in the middle and one on the far side. And he was telling me, well, just shove your come along out, you know, stretch out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, I'll hold on to this steel pipe and I'll hope that push out here. Yeah. And those steel braces, I mean, I had a death grip on those. My fingerprints are still in that one. He gets up and walks across those 6x8.
The beam
that are crowned on the top. And then he comes down and he's sitting on the other side of the pole from me, because the wires came up and went that way. And I figured, you know, he's going to do that. And he says, okay, now reach out and get another cut on that pole or on that wire so you can cinch it up. And so again, I'm holding on here and I'm reaching out. And he takes a crescent wrench and just wraps right across my knuckles. I'm just, I mean, it really hurt. And he said, up here, your hands work for the company. Your feet and your rear work for you.
So now you're comfortable in the harness.
No, I'm not comfortable. I hurt so bad I couldn't pull myself up. I did get better at it. Because now I was sitting all the way back.
Right.
And my feet stopped slipping.
Right.
And once that happened, it was like, the light went on, but I don't think it's going to let me get away from this pole going back down. But I climbed a lot of poles after that. Lots of neat people came up to work. The painters that did the first painting job of all the houses, as well as the outside of the dorms. If I remember correctly, the painter, the guy that owned the company, he brought his entire crew up and said, I'll pay you for 8 hours every day. But I want you to paint. We're not here to play around. We're up here to paint. Don't go be looking up there. And they found out that he was paying them out of his own pocket. And so they didn't work an 8-hour day. They worked from the time it got light until it got dark. And they really hustled. And they painted the windows and doors and roofs on all the dorms, as well as the windows, doors, and roofs and siding on the 13 houses. And I remember this one man. He would put up a ladder up to the second floor windows. And there's a typical window with two muttons that come down and three that go across. Well, that's a lot of cutting in. And this man, I would watch him walk up there. His hands were shaking so bad, how do you even hold on to the ladder? And he'd get up there and he'd dip the brush in there. He could draw a straight line from here to Seattle.
My goodness.
Hand never wiggled.
Magic.
I don't know what it was. And he was so much faster than the other people. He was up on the second floor. He would do two windows, and the guy down on the first floor would do one. They still had to use a ladder, but not like he was moving around. Mm-hmm. Just unbelievable the skills that some of these people brought with them.
Wow. So that crew did the all 14 of the chalets, the mm-hmm. houses. Did they do the lodges too?
They did all the dorms.
Uh-huh.
Did the roofs and the windows and doors on all the dorms.
They painted the roofs, on the dorms,
The metal roofs, yes.
Okay. Oh, they painted the metal roofs?
Yes.
Oh.
They had a neat little device they had brought up, and it had a set of wheels on it and a bracket that came out and sat down, and this tube had a spray gun on it. And the guy up at the top, he would move the top, and the bottom would just go with wherever he went, and the paint would come up through the hoses and would get up to the guns, and the guns were air powered. Now, he'd walk down, they'd unhook everything. By the time he got everything turned around, he could walk over on this side because the paint was dry.
Oh.
Do it on the other side, and won't go back that way.
Wow.
I've never seen anything like it before or since. So it was something that the owner of the company had.
Yeah.
Had figured out.
Were the original lodge roofs, were they kind of rusted, or what was the reason for painting them?
They were rusting.
They were rusting.
Yeah. And of course the house roofs were wooden shingles.
Mm-hmm.
And they badly needed a coat of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They protection. Just needed something for protection, right?
Yeah. And all the other buildings, and we were talking about this the other day when we were looking through the slides, they hadn't been painted before that. They were all just a stain, weren't they?
It was a stain, but it had been a long time since they had been restained. Mm-hmm. They had been stained when they were first put up. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they were done again.
Mm. Okay.
So I say paint, they continue to stain everything.
So it was probably 25 years since they had any sort of stain on
it. So
let's see. Was Wes Preeb around very much when you were there in those early times? Wes and Reuben and
he would come back and forth. He might be there for a week or two.
Okay.
And then he would leave. A lot of it was they would invite him up because they were having a special group coming up, and they wanted him to talk about how he mm-hmm. got into this.
Okay.
You know, the old simplified story is he saw that this place was up for sale, and he just wrote him a letter and said, would you consider less from... But first of all, was it still for sale? Yes, it is. Would you consider taking less from a nonprofit? And they said, yes. What's your proposal? And he said, how about free? And they accepted it. The only requirement was you had to prove that that it was a church. They didn't specify a church. It was a not-for-profit. And that's
and
when...
Here in the letter it says it was Lutheran Bible Institute.
Well, he was a student at Lutheran Bible Institute. And so he originally sent them the stuff saying, give it to the Lutheran Bible Institute. But that's where Gil and some of these other people came in. They said, there is no way LBI can manage something like this. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So they got the three denominations to go together and say they would do it. Mm-hmm. And that's when Reuben got into it. My dad got into it. My dad was putting on banquets.
Yeah, I saw a banquet slide, so I was going to ask about what that was about.
Dad and others, but he was kind of the instigator, and he would get you and you and you and you to do different things for a banquet. They'd hold them down in Seattle Center. Have a lot of people. They had tables in their exhibition hall. The whole, basically the whole hall would be filled up.
The one year, the woman that, what was her movie?
Von Trapp.
Von Trapp, yeah. But she actually came in as a speaker.
But they would put together these different things. My dad was a printer, and so he was doing the printing for the village. Just donating that, and this banquet thing was something that he really enjoyed doing. So he would start early in the year. We've got a reservation for this time, and we would like you to sponsor a table. We want you to sponsor a table.
Fundraisers for Holden.
Right, that's all it was. That was some of the early fundraisers. I don't...
And as a member of the family, we were all expected to...
Oh, yes.
yes.
A host to table.
A command performance.
right.
Absolutely.
And how did your dad and Gil... You said they were on a board together. Do you remember what board that was?
Church. They all belong to the same church. The same church that built the condo.
Yes.
Ah. If you weren't one of the... If you didn't come from Bethany to start out with, or Ballard First Lutheran, you couldn't get into that condo.
Bethany at Green Lake? Church or different Bethany?
Bethany in downtown Seattle. Next to Seattle Times, the old Seattle Times building.
Would that be the building's, Denny Park?
No, the building's gone now. It was called Bethany.
Okay, got it.
And
that church is no longer exists. Okay.
Sold it and tore it down. Actually, they sold that one and sold the Ballard Church and became Crown Lutheran Church.
Which is now closed, I think.
It's closed,
isn't it?
But that's where a lot of that, the people from there, Gil lived out in, not in Arden.
Blue Ridge Heights or something
Something like that. And then he moved into the condo. He was one of the first people to move in. And it was really interesting how that Rube and others put that together. Is that, okay, well, this unit out here is going to be this much, and this unit here is going to be less. We don't know how much less. And these units are going to be bigger, so there'll be more. And then as you went up, it went up a little bit in price, but not that much. Here's your buy-in price, and that buys the entire 15 units. And then as we sell off the last three or four units, I think it was, we'll take that money and divide it amongst the people that bought in first.
Oh.
So I think my dad's unit was like $26,000. For a two-bedroom unit.
Wow.
1970.
Oh, yeah. It's
right.
$1970, which are a lot more than today, but basically all the people that signed up first, they all knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
They either belonged to Bethany or to Ballard, and I can't remember if there was any from up on Greenwood or not. I don't remember.
Let's see.
I was going to say, does anybody want any coffee or tea or water? Okay.
No. I think that pretty well covers the questions I had. Other than for you, Karen, what, you know, tell us about the early kitchen, the kitchen stuff that you were doing.
Oh, I don't remember.
You don't remember?
I just went in and did what Esther told us to do.
The woman in charge, huh?
She brought me breakfast a couple times.
Well, that was nice.
No, you see, he remembers all that stuff. I don't remember that. It's the importance of keeping a journal. I'm beginning to realize that as you get older. That, gosh, I wish I kept a journal when I was younger. Yeah.
Well, how many summers were you up there?
Oh, I was there just once. Representative from Holden that came out to Valparaiso University and talked to students there, and I was in the youth ministry program there. And there were two of us, plus another, she was a sorority sister. She lives in Enumclaw, and you may have met her, Karen Bugey. I don't know if you've,
That's a familiar name.
She stayed on afterwards, but there were three of us that drove out from Chicago to Seattle and then went to Holden.
So you two met at Holden?
That's where we met, and here we are.
Yeah.
I always tell Mark that, I did an internship out in the Northwest in 62, and I just fell in love with, the Pacific Northwest, and I always tell him that that's why I married him, because I wanted to come to live in the Pacific Northwest.
And I tell her, I married her because she worked in the kitchen.
There you go. Right. These are the important things in life.
I know.
This is what forms our world. Well, that's great.
But love comes in there somewhere, doesn't it?
It kind of sneaks in, the unsuspected, like a 2x4 alongside the head. Well, when you were up there, did you ever go fishing and go up to the lakes?
I'm not a fisherman.
Uh-huh.
I did do some work on the snowmobile. We went places I shouldn't have gone. I climbed Copper Peak with a snowmobile.
Oh, goodness. Wow.
Almost to the top until I kind of resting a little bit. And what's that noise? And I got off the snowmobile and walked around the corner, and here's a big old snow slide coming down, rolling up trees, and decided I don't need to go any higher.
Yeah.
It's time to get out of here. But there wasn't room to turn around. I do remember trying to lift that stupid thing around in a circle so I can go back down on my track.
An early day explorer. Extreme sports.
Yes.
Right.
There were lots of hikes. I know you never went on hikes, but I know I did.
I went on one.
You do? Okay. I'll give you that.
When was it up?
There was three of us. We walked up Martin Ridge, and we walked the other side, and we got way back here. Okay, we're gonna stay overnight, and we did. And the next morning, I was sitting around. I can't remember if I said it first or somebody else said, we could possibly be someplace where no white person has ever been before, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we walked 50 feet from where we were, and here was this concrete monument about 3 feet square, about 3 feet high. U.S. Coastal Geodetic Survey, you are now 6,022 feet or whatever above sea level.
Oh, man.
Ruined the vision.
They brought concrete up here?
Well, it's like you guys bringing the radio and the battery up.
Yeah.
Same difference.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness sakes.
Yeah, I was just looking at the little map here, Lucerne Lake, Hart Lake.
So they had some reasonable trails and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there was,
Well, he was working, but we were, well, the volunteers worked too, but we went on different hikes, yeah.
Had a little more free time.
Probably.
Because I was one of the drivers, I just about every day drove down to the boat.
Wow, yeah.
Either in the bus or the truck.
Yeah.
A lot of people coming in, the flatbed had to go down, bring luggage.
Takes the time.
And my dad corrected me. He came up on one of the trips I was driving. I don't know if they even have it anymore. It was a white bus, had air brakes. And there was a couple switchbacks I knew that I couldn't make in one pass. I mean, you could go out here, but there's no guardrails on that road.
Yeah.
There wasn't. And I knew that if I got here, I could turn, but I wind up driving right into this rock wall. And I would just step on the brakes and then crank the wheel the other way and look out the mirror and start backing up. And the back end of the bus would hang right out over the back end.
Perfectly fine.
Yeah. Didn't bother me. I'm in the front of the bus.
But if you're in the bus.
There was a lot of sucking in of air going on back there in the back end.
Yeah. So my dad told me, he said, you know, when you go over all those washboards and the rest of it, remember, you're holding on to something. Nobody else is. Okay. I can learn that. At one time, they pumped all the effluent out of the septic up on top of the hill, trying to make things grow.
Yeah.
Rube and I and Harvey, when the snowmobile was working well, we would go up on top of the rock pile. Up at the 1,500 foot level. And we found that you could take the boxes that 8-foot fluorescent tubes came in.
Yeah.
You fold down one end, you fold this out, and you stick your feet down inside that box. Use it for a sled.
Yeah, perfect.
Until you got too far over this way, and you hit one of the pieces where they had the used to have the tanks sit on these platforms, and you hit one of those and you just go
painful.
Well, the first thing that happened to you is the box would stop and your feet would go all the way to the end of the box and you would be stretched out like this.
Life's adventures.
It was.
This has been wonderful. Thank you very much. It's just been wonderful sharing.
Yeah, anytime.